Welcome to the On the Verge of podcast, where we explore the world of politics and policy and focus on how tech companies can navigate the politics of disruption. In today's episode, Senior Vice President Adam Benson sits down with The Hill's former editor-in-chief, Bob Cusack, to discuss his 30-year career in journalism, how the media landscape has evolved, and some predictions for President Trump's second term in office. Hope you enjoy, and don't forget to smash that subscribe button.
Today's guest, Bob Cusack, has provided breaking news and vital information from Capitol Hill for more than two decades. In his work as editor-in-chief at The Hill, he shepherded the paper from scrappy underdog to trusted media source, covering Washington's lawmakers, regulators, and the political class. He spearheaded the paper's coverage of the Obamacare fight, the contentious confirmations of seven Supreme Court justices, and the January 6th insurrection. Under his leadership, The Hill has prospered where other media outlets have struggled. Late last year, Bob announced he would leave The Hill. We acted quickly to invite him to join us for our conversation. We're looking forward to talking to him about both the business and practice of journalism. Bob, thank you for joining us
here. Adam, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
It's really a great opportunity to talk to somebody who's been in there and seen it all. You're leaving The Hill after some very strong years, particularly over the last decade. The Hill itself has prospered, holding its own against Politico and Axios, and coming out ahead of its longtime rival, Roll Call. How did you do it?
Yeah, it was a struggle, and media has changed a lot, Adam, over the years. And, you know, Politico and Axios are bigger than The Hill, but if you look at our website traffic, and this is kind of a secret that not many people know, The Hill consistently gets more website traffic. That wasn't always the case. One of the things that we did is that The Hill used to be a niche publication. We used to have words like Washington, words like cloture in a headline. Okay. And we decided, and this was actually spurred on when Politico was born, we had to go more national. We're going to give the political junkies what they want, but we're going to make the news a little more digestible for someone like my wife, who's interested in politics but won't be caught dead watching C-SPAN. And soon after I took over as editor-in-chief, as we did that, even though I had been at The Hill a long time and my family and friends knew that, it was only after we went with that big national approach that my friends and family started posting our stuff on social media. So that showed to me, okay, people are getting it. We have to make this complicated Washington thing understandable and digestible. And I think we did that.
So about the business model at The Hill, it's a free publication that anybody can pick up.
Yep.
As they're walking around Capitol Hill, I don't think there's a paywall anywhere on the website that
nope.
I can think of.
Nope.
So how does that business model work, especially in comparison with some of the other papers that you mentioned, the legacy television networks, which are increasingly starting to use paywalls,
yep.
and national newspapers, which have used paywalls for a while? How are you competing with them?
Well, it's interesting. I think because we are open to the public in The Hill, now we have thought about, and The Hill may eventually get into some type of subscription, but because, you know, you have to deal with advertising, that's how The Hill makes its money, 95% of it, basically, because, as you know, Adam, every office on Capitol Hill gets free copies of The Hill and Politico and others. So I think as others were going to subscription and maybe moving left or right, we've seen that over the years, they knew they could come to The Hill and they didn't have to pay money. Again, they'd have to deal with some advertising pop-ups, but also that they could trust our news. And that was very important. But the model for us, and as it's such, well, I'm not there technically, but being there 21 plus years, and of course, I love the people there and I'm rooting for The Hill to continue its great coverage, has been, okay, you can come to us. We're free. We're down the middle. We don't care who's up or down. And I think that's helped both editorially with our audience, but also business-wise.
That down the middle part, I think, is really key and really important. And even when I was up at The Hill many, many years ago, that's how we thought of The Hill, down the middle. If you look at some of those charts and graphs that measure it, The Hill is always right in the center of it. So
exactly.
I think that's a key point that you're making there. And talking about journalism in general, it's working at The Hill. You guys are proving that this can still work. But what are some things that other news sources maybe could take away from what you did at The Hill and what's still going on there that they could implement to correct some of the problems that we're hearing of and seeing out there?
Well, it's a tough time for the industry. It's the worst time I've ever seen for political journalism, even in the Great Recession when Obama came in 2008, 2009. A lot of people were coming to Congress for handouts, for bailouts, and they were doing a lot of advertising. The Hill and other rivals of The Hill were doing great. Now it's different. There's a lot more competitors now. I do think that one of the reasons we've grown is that we don't play gotcha games. You mentioned studies. There are three media rating agencies. They all have The Hill down the middle. So, people come up to me. I play tennis, and they're like, "Hey, listen," and my tennis buddies are like, I can't watch this outlet or that outlet. I come to The Hill to figure out what's going on without being told how to think. And the best compliment, and I've gotten it from both sides of the aisle on many occasions, is you guys are tough but fair. And I've interviewed Donald Trump 5 times. And the first time he said, "Be fair," 4 times in the interview. And we put that in the story. But at the same time, we were tough but fair because the staff said, "You have 15 minutes. We ended up with 80 minutes. And then it led to subsequent interviews. So we didn't play gotcha with him. And I think a lot of the media has become a little bit too gotcha oriented and a bit smug. And that's why we're seeing media ratings that are the lowest ever.
It's an interesting point. And I want to drill down a little bit more on some of the things that you brought up about the practice of journalism and why it's struggling and what else you're seeing out there right now. There's so many outlets that we're hearing just of massive kinds of problems and people selling off properties and so forth. If you were given hold of another media outlet and told, "Here, do what you will with it," what are probably, let's say, 3 of the things you'd do first?
Well, you do have to tell people what they don't know. So they have to trust your source. Just like when you have somebody says, "Hey, you should check out this movie." You think about the source. Is it your crazy uncle or is it a close friend who you trust? "Oh, I'm going to watch that movie." So it has to be trusted. It has to tell you stuff you don't know. And I do think it has to not have one side or the other. And we've seen in corporate media biases, both on the left and the right, where the bosses are meddling. And I think that's hurt the media. Certainly bosses, if they own something, they can play with it. But a lot of those owners don't know anything about journalism. And I think that's hurt the field.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because I've heard of so many coming out of this last election, people increasingly turning to social media and podcasts in particular.
Yes.
And one of the things that people say about podcasts that I've read in different places is that podcasts provide the analysis of what's going on. It gives people sort of a leg up on what to think about the news of the day. And that increasingly people want to go further than just get the facts. They want to get that first set of thoughts. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is what I agree with or don't agree with. I'm wondering, how does a Just the Facts operation that provides that first draft of history, as they like to say, survive and prosper in the age of podcasts where people want that analysis?
Well, that's the big question. And it's a great question, Adam. I'm not sure because the media is at a crossroads right now. I do think that the formula for journalism is what's the news and why is it important? I think some organizations have gotten away from that. So when you're doing Just the Facts, you don't have to be boring. You have to be interesting. When people ask me at The Hill, "What do you look for?" Well, I mean, no one says, "Let's read a boring article. Let's go watch a boring TV show." I want interesting stuff that's within our purview. And our purview has grown. We used to just write about federal policymakers and not state. Well, it's all intermeshed now. So The Hill covers state politics. We cover different states. We have different people around the country now. So I do think the challenge is, how do you keep up when there are so many other publications out there? Then you have podcasts. And the interesting thing is we have 3 kids. None of them watch cable news. They get their news through whether TikTok or other social media. They're just YouTube, certainly. So that new generation, I think news executives need to get a handle on that because the media will never be the same than it was when Trump came into office. I don't know where it's going, Adam, but it's changing and it's going to rapidly change.
That is so true. The other day, my son asked me where could he find a football game. There was a football game he wanted to watch. Right. He asked me where he'd find it. And I said, it's on ABC. And he looked at me like, what?
How do I find ABC?
What does that mean?
Right. And then when they're talking about their stuff, I don't understand what they're talking about.
Exactly. Right. How am I going to find that?
Exactly.
So is there a world that you see where legacy media can compete with social media?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on competing. I think that one of the things that I was proud of at The Hill, other than we never had mass layoffs in my 20 plus years, is that a lot of people would type in, and they still do, thehill.com. And we know this from our research and data. That's very unusual because they trusted us and they said, you know, I'm not going to get now. Obviously, we get a lot of links through Drudge and other Real Clear Politics. But compared to other outlets, a lot of people are just doing that. So can legacy media compete with social media? I think it can. I do think that the legacy media, though, is going to be smaller in years to come. It's got to be nimble and scrappy. But I do think a lot of the social media stuff that you see out there, you know, I'm a Jets fan, and I saw some thing that I know is fake, that he's going to the Cowboys, and I'd even click on it. But I could see, you know, there's a lot of misinformation, even on silly stuff, sports. But when it's on serious stuff like politics, I do think that a lot of people have to think, okay, can I trust this source? We're in a misinformation age, and I'm worried about it. I don't think it's going to be ending anytime soon.
All right. First of all, you get a lot of credit for admitting to being a Jets fan, right?
Yeah, very loyal. Let me tell you. Let me tell you. And let me just tell you, I was on another podcast, a Jets podcast, and I never wanted Aaron Rodgers. Okay. So I'm on the record with that. And I was hoping I was wrong. I was right.
Well, you may be getting your wish because it sounds like maybe he's going elsewhere.
I think he is.
But people can check in on with that.
Yes.
With us later on that part. In terms of what Washington, not just the media, but those inside government as well, can take away from the America's reaction to the media coverage of Trump, what and this past campaign, what are some of the things that you think people should learn from and see from what happened there?
Well, listen, Trump is a character. He's a showman. Whether you like Trump or not, he's authentic. When people ask me, what's he like? I'm like, well, what you see is what you get. And it's worked for him. Now, of course, he says outrageous things, whether it's about crowd size, and a lot of it's false. I mean, let's face it, it's false. That said, I have seen the media go after him saying, here's an example where in his first term, he won 306 electoral votes. Now, there were a couple electoral votes that were rogue. You know, a couple people didn't vote the way they should have. So he technically got 304. And the media in his first term would say, oh, no, you didn't get 306, Mr. Trump. You got 304. Like, you have so much material with Donald Trump. You need to go to that level of gotcha? No. I think that's where people should realize, hey, listen, you got to hold people's feet to the fire. I think the media played gotcha way too much in his first term. I think the media is cowering a bit now to Trump because he's extremely powerful. You see these corporations are doing the same thing. Now, he's an incoming president. That happens all the time. He won the popular vote. I mean, no one predicted that. Nobody. But at the same time, politics changes. But I do think that Washington should just take a deep breath. And sometimes quick reactions and quick takes on X or other social media, just, you know, why don't you research it before, a little bit before having your quick take on it?
I want to talk a little bit about journalism and what you're thinking about with journalism. I mean, you're barely out of The Hill yet.
Yep.
But what are you thinking about doing over the next 30 years now that you got to think about that?
It's interesting. This is the first time in 30 years I haven't reported to work. And so I'm kind of going to enjoy taking a breath. That's what Pete Buttigieg said recently, the outgoing transportation secretary, because he's going to be leaving his job. So I'm going to enjoy being a free agent. I'm also a Mets fan. I'm not in as much demand as Juan Soto was, but I've had some conversations. It could be media. It may not be. I'm kind of going to take the next couple months to talk to people and have coffees and lunches and see what's out there. I want to do something that uses the skills that I have. But the most important thing, and this is what I tell aspiring journalists, I have a discussion with one lady this afternoon, do what you want to do. And that's what I told our kids. And thankfully, they have no interest in journalism. They are going to go into healthcare, which is a better choice, especially now. Do what you want. The money will take care of itself.
All right. Talking about the incoming administration and what to expect now over the next 4 years, which nobody can predict perfectly. We know it's going to be kind of wild.
Yeah.
But let's say this. Donald Trump has proven to be what Comedy Central era Stephen Colbert might refer to as a formidable opponent for the media. And now we're going into 4 years of Trump unchained. This is going to be bigger and badder and better than what we had last 4 years. He's learned from 4 years on the job, and then he's had 4 years to think about it, which that's a whole – we never had that in modern American history where someone's had a chance to digest what they just did and what went right and wrong. What do you expect him to do differently this time, and is the media prepared to cover it?
Great questions. I mean, Trump is he knows a lot more. I'm from New York, so I didn't get to meet Trump when he was in New York until we interviewed him, and I went to Trump Tower. But he didn't know D.C. rules. He didn't know congressional rules. He knew New York rules, and I knew that was going to get him in some trouble and was impeached twice. But still, now he knows the rules. Adam, when he first came into office in the first term, he didn't know he had pardon power. Okay, so now he knows he has that and plenty more. That makes him more dangerous to get stuff done. And dangerous, you know, obviously, some people want him to get a lot done, but he can be a lot more effective. And that's what I mean by dangerous. He knows the rules. Obamacare replacement, you remember, John McCain voted down. The first 6 months were a disaster. I think his first 3 months are going to be pretty good. We'll see what happens after that. But I do think I've never seen a presidential candidate on the Republican side go after the media so effectively as Trump. Prior Republican nominees would complain about the media, and that's how it sounded. They were complaining. Trump has used it as a weapon. And now with the media, he's done it during the 2024 campaign. He is suing a lot of media organizations and media organizations who are hurting. So for the first time in a long time, the media legacy media is incredibly vulnerable in a financial sense. And Trump knows that. So watch for that. Watch for a lot of lawsuits against the media. And he obviously is going to have, he nominated a friend to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. So there's going to be some big stories over the next 4 years on Trump's relationship with the media. He loves it, but he loves going after the media too.
That's the truth. That is the truth. At the time of this recording, we're a little more than a week away from the inauguration. And we're going to, of course, hit the first 100 days. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things you're looking for based on what you've seen and heard? What are some of the things we should look out for?
Well, he's going to learn from those Obamacare lessons. Their strategy back then wasn't that great. I think Susie Wiles, I think, is a very effective White House chief of staff. I think it's one of the best hires that Trump made, one of the key hires. I think they're going to be fast out of the gate. I think they would be smart. There's a big debate now. It's kind of inside baseball whether they're going to do one big bill with taxes, energy, and the border, or do you break it up and do the border and energy stuff first and then do taxes later. I think that's the latter is the better strategy because extending the tax cuts is going to be very difficult because the House majority is so tiny. So I would think the smart move would be get some points on the board on energy and the border, which unites Republicans, divides Democrats. There was a big vote on the Laken Riley Act in the House. 48 Democrats went with Republicans on that. So Democrats are feeling they're backing off on the border. Trump has the advantage. Tax cuts going to be a lot more difficult. So I see him, his first 100 days, I think he's going to have a lot more momentum than he did the first time. But after that, that's where the rubber hits the road.
That's what I was going to ask you next. What happens after the first 100 days? That's what really interests me. Like the first 100 days, there'll be the honeymoon period.
Yep.
And there'll be a lot of Republicans eager to agree with him on things and eager to line up behind him.
Yep.
But then after those first 100 days, we'll start seeing some of those polls come in. We'll start seeing some of those some feedback from people out there and maybe some people lining up against him.
Yeah. No, he's got some very thorny things on his agenda. And that doesn't even include foreign policy. But if you just talk domestic policy after the first 100 days, they're probably going to try to get rid of the Inflation Reduction Act, which Biden signed into law. Maybe they're going to get rid of parts of the transportation bill, or at least not spend the money that has been allocated for that. Getting rid of the Inflation Reduction Act is very difficult because it's kind of like Obamacare. Some parts are unpopular, but healthcare provisions on prescription drugs, on energy credits, a lot of Republicans like that, even though Republican voted for it, but now they like what they see. So they can't just do it a full repeal. They have to do it in pieces. That's going to be difficult. But the biggest issue is going to be those tax cuts. I do think the tax cuts will be extended, but some Republicans, and I've talked to some lawmakers over the last several weeks, and they think, oh, we can get this done by mid-year. No chance. This is going to go all the way to Christmas. And I think because of the narrow majority in the House, where you have one or two Republicans who can say, sorry, I'm not going to go along with that, because they need every Republican on board, just like that's how Obamacare passed. Every Democrat got on board eventually. There were some difficulties with getting Bernie on and others, but they did it. So maybe they do get every Republican on board. I doubt it. And I think by the end of 2025, I think they're going to need some Democrat votes. And I think they're going to go to Democrats and say, we'll give you X, Y, and Z. But tax cuts is going to be, I think, the second part of the year, and it's going to dominate the headlines. But also watch out for tariffs, because that affects inflation, and that could hurt. Trump's going to be very careful with that. Trump could really damage his popularity if there's a big reason why he got elected was combating inflation.
You're actually getting into my next question, but I'm going to pivot for just a moment and ask you one other. Who are the Republican members, particularly the House, that we should watch as sort of a temperature check and see how things are playing, or maybe are inclined to give us an initial inclination as to what's working, what's not working, or what may not play well with enough Republicans to get through the House?
You got to watch, a couple, obviously watching the leaders. Senator John Thune is the new majority leader, one of the nicest guys in Washington. He may be too nice for that job. I think he has a good relationship and is going to have a good relationship with Speaker Johnson, who has the toughest job in Washington. But the others to watch are Republican vulnerables. You know that history says, and maybe it won't happen, but history says that in the midterms, the political party in power does very poorly. So the House is likely to flip. So you got to watch people like Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican from Pennsylvania. He's a moderate, but Democrats are always going after him. Those type of Republicans who are always like, okay, wait a minute. We can't go that far because I don't want to lose my job. So watch the political vulnerables and also watch the leader's relationship, especially John Thune, who has had an okay relationship with Trump and Speaker Johnson, and how those three leaders deal with all the problems in the months ahead.
You talked a little bit about tariffs previously and what the potential threat those are. I wonder if you dig deeper and talk about other threats to his success and other things that are looming out there. Maybe there are things that were talked about on the trail and discussed, but now that we're actually governing, look a lot more complicated than initially when they were discussed on the trail. Talking about prices of groceries seems to be one of those things. Maybe Ukraine might be one of those things as well.
Yeah, well, let's tackle foreign policy. I think his second term will be defined by foreign policy challenges. China is, during these 4 years, has threatened, and the CIA believes will try to invade Taiwan. The Ukraine-Russia war is ongoing. We have obviously massive the Israel-Gaza conflict continues and no end in sight here. So and the President Biden struggled with all these. Now Trump has talked big about resolving all of them. So that's on one hand. Of course, you have North Korea, you have Iran. I mean, you've got more foreign policy challenges, I think, that we've seen in recent memory. But back home, Trump has to worry about inflation. He has to worry about really the debt too. Part of the problem with passing the tax cuts is that we're $36 trillion in debt. And Republicans, this is not, this is not the George W. Bush party anymore. This is not the U.S. Chamber of Commerce party anymore. This is Trump's MAGA party. But a lot of the conservatives up on Capitol Hill in the House Freedom Caucus are like, listen, I like tax cuts, but we got to pay for them. We can't just add to the debt, which actually $4 trillion. So I think the debt, and that is also, military experts have said, the debt is a major national security problem. Trump has shown at some point, and lawmakers don't like talking about this on either side, they're going to have to tackle Medicare and Social Security. That's the only way you're going to really tackle the debt. We have an aging population. Congress has been scared to touch either one, and they're waiting too long. But the debt is going to cause Trump problems, I think.
You make a great point about foreign policy. And I'm kind of struck by right now as we speak, there's a lot of conversation about Greenland.
Yes.
And taking over Greenland. And it has provided a lot of fodder for late night comics. I watch it and I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I'm not advocating taking over Greenland.
Right.
But if you listen to him a little bit talk about it, like he did at a press conference recently, mm-hmm. there is something underlying that that's sort of interesting, which is this idea that shipping lanes in the Arctic are at risk and we're running into real problems there. And it seems like he is thinking about that and proposing kind of unconventional ways to deal with it. I don't know if the part about Greenland is going to fly, but
right.
it seems like underneath some of the crazy ideas, every now and then there's something that pops out that's like, hey, that is something we should be thinking about and talking about.
No, I mean, Senator Schumer, as far as like the idea of renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, Democrats are picking their spots. And he said that's a zany idea, but fine if he wants to do that. Now, as far as using military force for Greenland or other Panama Canal, you know, that's not going to happen. But I do think there's a method to the madness. And Trump knows he's playing some three-dimensional chess. He's not going to get Greenland, but maybe he gets something else for nothing. You know, we've seen that in his first term, Mexico didn't pay for the wall, but they did make some concessions over the 4 years on other items. So I think he wants to get something for nothing. So then he starts with this big idea that's probably not going to happen. And remember, Donald Trump has also highlighted that he is a peacetime president. He knows this country is very wary of war. We're not ready for war, at least a two-front war. That's been said. So I think a lot of it is just he likes to talk some crap. And throw people off, and that's honestly part of the reason why he's going to be president again.
Again, just for the record, on my part, because I would like to visit Greenland someday.
Yes.
I'm not advocating to take over Greenland.
To be clear,
just
right?
Have to put that out there. It's no secret that Trump is a transactional guy, and that's really yep. long lines that he thinks about. If you don't have $1 million to burn on an inauguration contribution right now, what can someone do? What an organization do to get on his radar and be in the loop in his conversation?
Well, I think as we talked about, Trump loves and hates the media. So, and then the media is different. Now, you know, Elon Musk says everyone can be the media. So, and certainly some people have come out of the woodwork with podcasts. I mean, part of the reason why I think Trump easily won is that he didn't fear the media. I think both Hillary Clinton and Harris to some extent did. Trump went on Joe Rogan for 3 hours. And then there was a big negotiation between Harris and Rogan's team, and it never happened. And, so listen, I do think that getting in Trump's orbit is you've got to kind of make yourself a star, make some connections. And of course, you know, flattering Trump, if you have a chance to be in the room with him sometime, always works. I remember my first interview with Trump, I had mentioned that my son, who's not really interested in politics, but Trump was coming on the scene and he was, you know, 15 or 16. All his friends were going to watch the debate. This is my son never watching in politics. And I said, why are you going to watch the debate? And my son said, Trump. And I said, but why? He's like, he's funny. Okay. So I told that story to Trump in our first interview. And he was like putty in my hand afterward. And I'm thinking, this guy gets elected president. Foreign leaders would be wise to flatter. So flattering Trump, if you can get him or his people. But having a big media presence is very important, or having a lot of power, or as you started that question, having a lot of money. And a lot of those companies that have given $1 million, remember, after January 6th, they said, we're not giving any money to anyone who voted with Trump on contesting the election. They have changed there too.
It shows how things have changed. I'm glad you brought up Joe Rogan too, because I think I'm really looking forward to the 2024 campaign book, whoever writes it.
Yep.
It goes into detail on that Joe Rogan decision by the Harris campaign.
No, absolutely. And let me give a plug to my former colleague, but still very close friend, Amy Parnes, has written another colleague who also worked at The Hill, Jonathan Allen. They wrote the book Shattered, which is a post-2016 election. They wrote the book Lucky, which is the post-2020, and they are now working on another book that's going to come out relatively soon on all those questions, and they're going to have a lot of juicy detail about the 2024 election.
I share your appreciation for Amy Parnes. She is terrific.
She's fantastic.
She is a great journalist.
Yes.
In the first term, it seemed like Trump wanted advocates who provided volume in every sense of the word. They wanted people who were not only loud, but popular. And it seems like Trump now wants allies who provide more than just volume. They're actually people who provide intelligence or thought or actionable items that he may be able to work on. That's my sense. Am I crazy in thinking that?
No. I mean, Trump wants a lot. There's no doubt about it. He monitors polls very closely. He has a personal touch. I think one of the things, just as a side, why did he win the Republican nomination? Remember, DeSantis was kind of the favorite, especially after January 6th. What did Trump do? He started calling Florida lawmakers and said, "Hey, will you endorse me?" Trump has that effect. And so he wants to get the endorsement, but he also, that's what he wants, but he also owes you a little bit something. And sometimes he will repay it. But there is no doubt about it that Trump is very transactional, but a lot of politicians are. But Trump, if you offer him one thing, if you offer him like a candy bar, he wants a whole meal. So, but he does repay you unless he turns on you. So watch that to see, you know, Trump had a lot of loyalists who turned on him in the first term. He has a second term team that is far more loyal, I think, than the first term, but we're going to see some conflicts and we're going to see some people that Trump fires in his second term as well.
So let's go on the other side of the fence now. And you're a Trump opponent.
Yeah.
If they came to you and said, "Bob, what should I do? How should we go about things right now?" What would you advise them?
Well, it's interesting. The Democratic Party is taking a different approach this time around. And I think it's smarter than just because they were just in shock after 2016. Now, in a lot of ways, you can argue 2024 to Democrats was worse than 2016 because they knew what was coming and they still couldn't stop it. I think you got to pick your spots. I also think you have to stop being preachy. I think the Democratic Party has gotten very preachy about some issues that are not top issues and focus on bread and butter. I remember in 2006 when Democrats were in the wilderness and they didn't have control of Congress and they were trying to get back control of Congress. Well, what did Chuck Schumer and Rahm Emanuel constantly talk about? Middle class, constantly. And I think the Democratic Party, it's not like they didn't talk about that, but I think they got away from that. And I think they need to pick their spots. I think it's smart for Democrats to say, like, Trump has an idea of limiting credit card late payments. Okay. Mm-hmm. Democrats like that idea. So do I think that bill is going to pass? No, but I think Democrats should say, "I want to work with the president on X, Y, and Z." But they also need a nominee who talks plainly, who talks like a real person. And at times, whether that's Biden, Harris, or Hillary Clinton, sometimes they would let their guard down. You have to be authentic. You can't be playing a role. And listen, we've seen this on the Republican side. You know, Marco Rubio, when he ran in 2016, he was in one of those primary debates, and he was just reciting talking points. And Chris Christie just shut him down and basically called him out. Talking points don't work anymore. Knocking on doors doesn't work anymore because people don't answer the door. We didn't when they knocked on our door. Calling people. It's a different environment, and Democrats have to modernize, I think.
Interesting. The best reporters that I deal with and that I work with usually finish up an interview by saying, "Is there something that I missed that I should have asked you?"
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that I missed that I should have asked you?
It's a great question. One thing we would ask our sources that I was trained to ask is after you would ask about topic A, when you'd call somebody, and that's when you actually called people, you'd say at the end, "Well, what else is going on?" Because sometimes they would tell you something better. But as far as I just want to emphasize the changing media landscape, I think over the next 5 years, it's going to change in ways we've never seen. I think it's a revolution, whether it's, you know, obviously podcasts, social media, the media trying to hang on in a way and not be a shell of itself. But in 5 years or maybe less, I just think it's going to be a whole new world out there. Now, everybody needs information, valid information on news that's true and reliable. That's not going to change. But how do you deliver that news and how do people want it to be delivered? That, I think, is going to be one thing to watch in the second term.
It's a great place to end this. We're looking forward to getting this out there to the world as well and people joining us and listening in. Bob, I look forward to seeing what you do in the days, weeks, and months to come. But I hope for now you really enjoy this time off and maybe get to enjoy the Mets a little bit.
Yeah. Jets are rough. I got to focus on Mets and Knicks a little bit. But Adam, I really enjoyed this. Thank you for the invitation. Really appreciate it.
And thanks to everybody for joining us on the On the Verge Of podcast. Look forward to talking to you all at some other point in the very near future.